In this episode of Startups of the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss allocating your marketing budget, minimum SaaS documentation, and we answer more listener questions. This is Startups of the Rest of Us, episode 380. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. What is the word this week, sir?
Well, if I had a way to put an emoji in here, I'd put a sad face in because my new website is not live yet. I was expecting it to be done, but...
It's been a couple weeks since we recorded last.
Well, yeah, I handed things off to a designer and he was working on it. And then some stuff came up and he wasn't able to finish it on the kind of a previously proposed schedule. So it's, you know, completely understandable stuff that, you know, completely out of his control. But it's a little disappointing. Things got pushed off a little bit, but, you know, still plodding forward and hoping that things will be pushed out and live within the next week or so anyway.
Got it. So next podcast episode, I will give you a bunch of crap if it's not live.
Hey, yeah, sure. And you can evaluate the design and I can tell you to go to hell.
Hey, Mike, I would tweak these three things. Boy, that's really an odd color. And then you're like, dude, stop. Seriously. It's all done. I'm going with this.
I like fluorescent orange.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
But yeah, I mean, things are, you know, I'm just kind of in a holding pattern right now, waiting for that to get all squared away so that I can kind of launch some other marketing campaigns and see how things go.
That's cool. It'll be nice to get that. I'm excited to see it because like we talked about a couple episodes ago, your current site doesn't do the product justice. So interested to see what it looks like. For me, I was in San Francisco last week at Saster, and I will admit, I liked it better this year than last year. I've only been to two Sasters, and my general appraisal is they are way too damn big, way too big. They say that there are 10,000 people there, and it feels like more than that. I really think they should A, sell fewer tickets, and B, there's this big emphasis on like, bring your whole team. So like half the people you talk to, it's like, I run marketing for this startup. I am in support. And it's like nothing against that, but I don't get a lot of value out of that. You know, I want to be with other founders or I want to be with, if it's a marketing conference, I want to be with people who are marketing, but it's this really broad swath of people. So I find the lack of focus and the size to be pretty detrimental to the conference. I think it would be better. But see, I think the point there is different than like we do with MicroConf, where it's like highly focused content and we try to get the people together. A lot of people were just there to network and business meetings. And it wasn't even hallway track conversation. It was like one guy I saw in the lobby. I'm trying to think. I think he recognized me or he recognized the Drip name, one or the other. And he said, yeah, longtime Drip user. I just line up like seven meetings a day here. I don't go to any of the sessions. So there were people who came and did just that, which I'm sure is fruitful, but it's an interesting way to view the conference. I participated in about four or five meetings over the course of the 3 days myself.
Yeah, I used to go to the Symantec and Altiris conferences out in Vegas, and it was the same type of thing. There were people who would go solely so that they had easy access to people to line up meetings one after another, and that was like the only reason that they went. They didn't go to any of the sessions or anything. It was just go there to talk to people.
Yeah, so with that in mind, I went to somewhere between three and five meetings, so I did miss a few sessions, but with that in mind, my learnings this year were that the panels in general, not just Saster, I've never seen a panel that's any good. They always tend to be watered down. And even if the topic is super intriguing, it's like, they're just not well done. And that's one of the reasons we don't do panels at MicroConf, right? I think we've done one panel and out of the 14 or 15 MicroConfs we've run, and we set it up very specifically and we gave everybody heads up and asked them to be super tactical. But I just started avoiding the panels early on in the conference, the Saster conference. And I was only going to the solo where it was one person because I knew that they would have slides and they would have thought through a premise and be making a point and having an opinion. And that's what I really enjoyed about it, where I saw several talks that were good. They were like, I'll say, you know, MicroConf quality, really high bar with a lot of from experienced people, like a former product leader at Box.net as an example. So you know that she has, you know, a lot of experience and knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I've never really seen panels work out very well to the point that they're interesting and you get any reasonable takeaways from them. And I wonder if that has a lot to do with, I don't think it's just the format, but I also think that it's a matter of trying to give everybody either equal opportunity to talk or, you know, I think another contributing factor is the issue of having questions that aren't necessarily, I'll say, as well prepared as like a talk. Because if somebody's up on stage, they've given their talk generally a fair amount of thought behind it and, you know, have like a story arc or something like that. And there's background and they can do lead-ins and to different pieces of the story. But with a panel, you can't do that at all. It's very difficult to establish rapport and create some sort of an arc that people can follow.
I mean, that's a good point. Like, we're touching on some things that could be fixed. One thing, Jason, because I was talking to Jason Cohen, he was there, he did a talk, and then and he and I were hanging out talking, and we were having this exact conversation, and he suggested, he said, you know what, if you instead made it a debate, it would be way more interesting. And you either get, so it's a panel, but it's essentially a debate. And then I said, wow, but so then don't do three-person panels, just have two. Can you imagine, like, Jason Cohen, Heaton Shaw up on stage. All right, I want one of you to take the side of bootstrapping, one to take the side of raising funding. And then we're going to go through six topics and we're going to say, all right, how does this impact hiring? Go. And the two of them debate. And then how does this impact, you know, how fast you can grow? Go. How to, you know, just run through these topics. And it was that I was suddenly intrigued by.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. As soon as you started mentioning that and saying that you're going to have two people like Heaton Shaw and Jason Cohen up on stage and kind of debating something, I was like, well, what happens when they agree on something? And it's like, well, yeah, you have one of them take opposing sides. That makes more sense.
You'd have to set it up in advance to either that they, even if they don't fully believe it, they just do it. Like if you know, folks who are on the debating team or have done debate, that you just have to do that, right? You sometimes have to debate something that you have to be on the side that you don't agree with, or you pick issues that you do know that they're on the opposite sides of. So you and I could debate things like,
who's going to win an arm wrestling match?
Who's going to win an arm wrestling match? We could inbound and outbound email because you're outbound and I'm inbound. Anyways, that was dumb. So I know, I'll say coming up with things off the cuff, not my strong suit. This is why I prepare talks, right?
Yep.
All right. So we're going to answer some listener questions this week. First question is a voicemail. It's about allocating your marketing budget. This question comes to us from our very own Craig Hewitt, the founder of Podcast Motor and Seriously Simple Podcasting.
And Castos now.
Hey, Rob and Mike, this is Craig Hewitt from the Rogue Startups Podcast. I had a question for you guys today about how you would think about allocating marketing budget. So say you have $1,000 a month you want to spend on marketing for a SaaS tool. How would you think about allocating that money for different things like content or SEO or paid acquisition? And let's say that it's a relatively young SaaS product that is, you know, say below a few $1,000 a month in MRR. Interested to hear your thoughts around how you'd approach this problem and if you have any specific answers that you think would be kind of best practices. As always, love the show. Thanks for everything you guys do.
I think this is an interesting question because the parameters of the problem here is that you have $1,000 for the month, and what marketing activities do you prioritize for your business, or how do you go about evaluating them? And I think that in some ways the question is almost misphrased because not everything is going to have a dollar cost associated with it, and especially if you're bootstrapping and you're early on and you are able to do things yourself. So for example, if you're doing SEO, there's not really a dollar cost associated with that. It's actually more your time than anything else, versus if you're doing paid advertising where clearly there is a budget that you have to set aside and you have to be able to do that, or if you're paying people to write articles. But at the same time, you could also write those articles yourself. So it's a question of resource allocation, not necessarily just dollars. So there's the time of yourself for doing it, and then there's the money associated with those things, and then there's the output of that. Like, how much are you going to be able to reach people? How far or how broad is your reach going to be after you spend the money and the time? And I think that that's probably the most important thing to focus on is what is your reach going to be based on the resources that you have spent. So if you spend half your time for the month and you're able to get 10 times the reach than if you were to spend $1,000 or even $2,000, then you're going over your budget at that point, but you're not going to be able to get to as many people. So I would look at it in terms of reach and then refine that over time, because you're probably not going to get it right right in the first month, you're probably not even going to get it right in by the third or fourth month. You'll be able to narrow it down and you'll be able to start eliminating different options. But I would probably focus on most three different things in any given month. And then at the end of the month, evaluate them against one another to see how far of a reach did you get and was it qualified? Like, did you reach the right people? Because if you're not reaching the right people and you're not getting to a scale that you need, then it means that channel or whatever it was that you were trying is basically worthless. It doesn't do anything for you. Now, if you can get in front of them and you are doing it at a rate that is, I'll say reasonable, and that's going to depend a lot on what your channel is, because 1% in one channel could be, you know, you should expect 50% in another. But as long as it's reasonable, then I would essentially double down on that and refine it and optimize it. But if you can't get anywhere close to what is reasonable based on what objectively other people are telling you that they're seeing in their industries, then I would switch to a different tactic and see if that one works out, because it's going to be different for every type of business and every type of product.
Yeah, the way I would think about this is, it's actually an approach that I used to do. Well, I did it for Hittail and did it for Drip. And I saw Noah Kagan doing something similar, but better. And it's to basically take a Google spreadsheet or an Excel spreadsheet and write out all your marketing approaches and then try to guesstimate how many trials you think or visitors you think you can drive from it. And you put the cost, estimated level of effort, for hours, whether that's for you or if someone on your team is doing it. And then you just try to sort them, and you come up with a simple algorithm to sort probably by impact, unless there's something that's substantially more effort. You just want, sheer volume of trials or new customers or revenue, however you want to measure that. Early in the SaaS app's career, assuming you have product market fit where people are using it, paying for it, churn is low, all you're trying to do is find marketing approaches that work. And you're very likely going to, for small SaaS app, you're going to find one, maybe two. You'd love to have 10, but it's going to be one or two that's going to have the most impact over time. And so I like to think of them, there's short term and there's long term, right? The short term ones are like doing a joint venture mailing where you email your list and, I'm going to say podcast because we know that Craig runs Castos, which is a podcast hosting, and let's just assume that's what he's looking at. So, you'd find either a podcast blog or someone who, does a podcast about podcasting and ask them to mention it. And then you would also, mention their podcast to your audience or something like that. That's a little bit of a quirky way to do it, but you get the idea. Maybe there's another SaaS, podcasting SaaS that helps with recording like Zencastr or something. And you do a JV with them where they email your people and you email yours. Then there's just straight up affiliate stuff. And that's where you could approach people and just say, look, I'll pay you 30% perpetual, or 20% perpetual revenue, top line revenue from anybody you refer. And here's your link and see how many people would do that. There'd be podcast advertising. And the reason I keep coming back to podcasts is because your audience's podcast hosts are most likely to listen to other podcasts. And so you could just start buying spots on those podcasts that are talking to other content creators. There's paid ads, which these days I'm going to say is Facebook. Like AdWords is going to be very unlikely. It's just going to be too expensive for you to get to work, although you could try it. Outbound email. So these are all the short-term things. And when I say short-term, they can work for a long time, but they can give you a short-term boost, right? And they'll instantly, if you do a JV mailing, boom, you'll get a bunch of customers that day. And then, or hopefully you do. And then you have to do another one, every month in order to make it work. Then there's these longer kind of flywheel things, stuff like SEO, content marketing, even I'll say guest posts is kind of in the middle there. It depends on, I think guest posts can get you a one-time shot, but they also build up SEO over time. So you may want to do both. But honestly, if I were in your shoes and I was just getting started, I would go for a bunch of the short-term wins, because when you're doing, and I don't know Craig's revenue, but I'm going to throw out, when Hittail was doing 1500 or 2 grand a month, all I wanted to do was get it to 5 or 10 grand a month. I didn't care if it was unsustainable. The marketing approaches were completely didn't scale at all. As soon as I got to 5 or 10 grand, I had so many more options. I could hire better people. I could hire more people. I had huge budget then to market. I wasn't constrained to the $1,000. I didn't have very high expenses. So I had 5 to 8 grand a month to market this thing. Now things really open up for you. And then you can start doing multiple, right? All right, I'm going to get a blog going with landing pages and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I have to admit, if I was marketing a podcast hosting service, I love the idea of, where all your customers are. they're all in the iTunes store. Like, this is, it's like the best deal ever to be marketing to that audience. It's not a huge audience, but you know where they all are. And you know that the business podcast and any kind of for-profit podcast that takes advertising is making money versus, you know, there's a lot of hobbyist podcasts talking about whatever, Dungeons and Dragons or movies or whatever. They're going to be, it's more like a B2C sale, right? So you're going to want to stick to the more popular ones, and you're going to want to stick to certain categories that common sense is going to tell you if these people have money and are going to be willing to pay for it. So that would probably, to me, be the very first thing I do is, you know, either have a VA scrape or write a scraper, because you know all the iTunes pages are on the web, you know, in the browser. And hopefully I'm not, you know, hopefully Craig hasn't already come up with this. It's like some secret sauce thing and I'm totally giving it away, but I'm just coming off the top of my head and thinking how I would begin to approach it. Maybe I would test some paid advertising, but probably not before I did outbound email, joint venture mailings, affiliate, trying to get some affiliates to work with me. And even joint venture webinars are interesting. I don't know if that one's going to work in this space, but to basically latch onto someone else's audience and be like, hey, you know, let's do a webinar to each other's audiences, or you say, hey, can I do it to your audience, Mr. Podcaster, and you fill the seats and then I'll give you a cut, you know, of whatever the people buy. So I realize that's a long answer, but that's how I would think about it. And with $1,000 a month, I would, like I said, I would test things until something worked, because then that something working buys you the luxury of being able to do multiple things at once. And while I was testing, I would really stick to one thing at a time, and I would hustle and I'd learn everything about it that I know, and I'd read up on it and I'd immerse myself in it for 1 to 2 weeks of just like consuming content about it and buying the Udemy course and watching the MicroConf talk and talking to XYZ expert about it, you know, calling them up on Clarity and paying them their $3 a minute that they need. And then once I figured I had my head around it, I would just dive in deep. This is what I did with Hitail back in 2012, I think it was. I just picked a topic that I thought would work and dove into it. And then I spent 1 to 2 months just hammering on it. And if it didn't work, I moved on to the next one. And the ones that did made that app. You know, they made it so that I was able to grow it as substantially as I did. So great question, Craig. I appreciate you sending that in. Our next question is another voicemail, and it's about what documentation you might need for a SaaS.
Hi, Mike and Rob. Thanks so much for your podcast. It's been so useful over the years I've been listening to it. My question today is around documentation, and what do both of you think you need as standard to run a SaaS online business? So I'm looking for things like a test document to do routine tests on new releases, for example, checking everything's still working. Documentation on service processes, service definitions. The list could be endless, but I'd really like to hear from you in terms of what you think you need structurally in terms of a documentation set to operate, to run your businesses. And also, what's required, do you think, for selling a business as well? What would be seen to be required by someone looking to invest or purchase your business? Thanks once again.
So I think there's actually two questions here. One is, what is the documentation that you need internally to run the business? And then the second one is, what do you need to have in place in order to sell the business? And I think that the two answers to that can be on completely opposite extremes. In order to run the business, at the very least, and again, this may depend on how complicated your business is, but there are businesses that are run with everything in the founder's head, and that's really all they need because it's small enough and it makes enough money that there's not a lot of things that they need to do on a day-to-day basis that are going to be things that they're going to forget how to do. Then as your business gets more complicated and as you add more people into the business, that's when you need to start documenting things and having things, processes written down so that whoever you bring in to help you out, they can follow those and you don't have to micromanage them. Because that's really why you're bringing somebody into the business, is so that they can do those things without you having to do them yourself. Some of it's for scalability purposes of the business. Some of it's just you don't have enough hours the day, but all of those things need to be documented so that you don't have to still be involved in those things that you're hiring somebody else to do. When you get to the point where you're selling the business, that's probably where there's going to be a lot more documentation that's going to be needed so that when somebody comes in to take over the business, they are going to be able to pick up the business and run with it without you having to be involved. So again, this is a little bit more advanced if you're going to be there for the next year or two, it's probably not as big a deal. So if, like, if somebody's acquiring your business and you're required to be with them for the next 18 months or 24 months or 36, whatever it happens to be, that's probably less important, but it still probably needs to be done at some point along the way, because they don't want to run into a situation where, let's say, you step out on the street, you get hit by a bus and killed. They've bought this asset that they don't know how to leverage and continue to make money from. And that's a very valid concern for the acquirer. But if it's something small and it's very simple to run and operate, you're probably going to need less documentation. So there is that sliding scale, and it depends a lot on your business complexity, revenue, number of employees, and overall risk tolerance, I'll say.
Yeah, when I think of internal documentation, which is what we're talking about here, I think of two types. I think of processes. Like, hey, this is how you, non-technical processes, you know, this is how you do a marketing campaign, or this is how you check support, and this is how you respond to these, kind of a wiki type thing. And then I think of kind of the technical docs of, if stuff goes down, this is how you repair it, this is what the architectural schema is like, and the endpoints and stuff. And again, that's all internal. If you have an API that's external, you obviously need to document that, but let's just keep internal docs in mind. For internal processes, I never created documents until I was ready to hand it off to a person. If I was doing it myself, I did not spend the time. That has always worked. It's like just-in-time documentation. And often the way I would document it is I would bring the person on and say, all right, here's your job. It's to check the support emails and respond to these. Please look through the history. So I've responded, and I'm going to either throw together a Google Doc, or I would throw together like a screencast. And then I'd say, can you turn that into a wiki so that if we bring a second person on, that you can train them using the material? So I put the burden on the person doing it. I delegate that to them to kind of create the processes. This is just the way I do it. This is way more time efficient for me. I don't enjoy creating the processes. You know, if you do, then by all means, you can do it. It's going to be better than the person creating it themselves. But for me, I'm trying to get stuff done in the business, and I don't want to spend a bunch of time writing a bunch of stuff up. For technical documentation, if you're a single developer and you're working on it, I would veer very much on the side of less documentation, purely because a lot of us came from these enterprise backgrounds. I mean, I was coding in Java and .NET and doing these big consulting projects, and we had to document everything. You don't want to do that for your startup. It's a waste of time until you're bringing more people on and trying to get them ramped up. And even then, like even these days, with as complicated as Drip is, we basically have a GitHub wiki where we have, you know, kind of articles written by internal developers on different subsystems. And then we do have these things called runbooks. I'm not sure if you've heard this term, but it's a developer term, kind of a DevOps term, to describe how to run a system. And that if you get a page that something is down, you know, if you get a text that PagerDuty pages you that something's down, you go to the runbook for that subsystem, and it's supposed to tell you how to troubleshoot and how to do things. Those are valuable. We did not have those until we were at probably 8 to 10 engineers. And it didn't feel like we did it too late. It didn't at all. I'm glad we have them now, but it wasn't like we were running around for years with our hair on fire because we didn't have this documentation. With that said, Derek was more stressed out than I would have liked and than he would have liked, because we didn't delegate that stuff soon enough, and Derek was on call for years. It was too much. So that is probably the one regret, is it would have been nice to have some runbooks early on. But to document a system, like extensive detailed system documentation, falls out of sync so fast when you're in a startup and not doing waterfall development like we did 10 years ago, that I would go very documentation light until there comes a time when you really need it, and then you can document it. So that's a good question. Thanks for sending that in. I hope that helps. Our next question is from Eowyn from Bite Size Irish Gaelic. And his question is that he's a developer, and he has a question about hiring a developer to write code. And he says, hi, Mike and Rob, what are your thoughts on hiring a developer contractor rather than doing my own development? Do you generally see more leverage in stepping away from development? I'm thinking of Michael Gerber's book, The E-Myth Revisited, and I lean towards not being a developer/technician, as he calls it, in my business. Having said that, there's time and energy involved in hiring and delegating, and on Odesk, a good developer can be $40 an hour. Admittedly, what probably muddies the water on my question is that I like development. I've had a few developers working on my projects over the years, and it's hard psychologically to let go of the development to someone else. I found the best flow to be developing new features for my web app. That's not to say I get great satisfaction from trying to orchestrate the growing of the business. This really is my life's work. Possibly a better way for me to ask the question above is, how can I train my thinking to allow myself to get out of the way of my business's growth? What do you think, Mike?
Well, there's obviously definitely opportunities to hire somebody as a developer and pull yourself out of that particular role. And as long as you hire the right person, that can be awesome, because it will remove you from the heavy lifting of, you know, writing the code day in and day out and having to flip back and forth between things like marketing activities and sales activities, and then going hardcore into the software development and then diving into customer support. The ability to replace yourself in one of those areas that requires a lot of mental overhead is, I won't say priceless, but there's a lot of value in being able to do that. That said, I would also ask the question, what is it that you are probably the best at? Is it writing code? Like, is it going to be that for you? Or are you much better at doing marketing activities? And I would kind of make the conscious decision about whichever one of those roles you provide the most value for, you take on that responsibility and probably stay there. It's not to say that you, if you're a developer, you can't learn marketing or that you're not going to be any good at it. But what is it that you enjoy doing? And what is it that really kind of excites you and drives you forward every day? Because if you like diving back into the code and you do it constantly, it's going to be very difficult for you to step away from that and hand it over to somebody else and let them make all the difficult technical decisions. Now, you can, in some cases, like stay heavily involved in the development side of things if you want to switch over to marketing, if that's your passion. But I will say that it's difficult to do both like heavy marketing activities and also be heavily involved in like the product architecture side of things, especially if your app gets to any level of complexity. It's going to be difficult. So I would just keep those things in mind. But it's a balancing act. I mean, you can, there's no one right way that's going to work in every situation. It's really about what is going to work for you and what is going to be less distracting for you. Because if you're in the middle of an email campaign and you're thinking, God, I wish I could go in and fix this code, for example, and then you start doing it, you're actually hurting yourself. Even if you have somebody else there who can do it and they are tasked with it, you're basically hurting the relationship or the parameters of the employee contractor agreement by taking things over and doing them, because then it's going to feel to them like, oh, this person doesn't trust me, or I'm being micromanaged. And, you know, then you introduce yourself to a world of other problems that you had no idea that you were going to run into.
Yeah. And to add one more piece of information, because we often shorten emails people send, and I skipped one paragraph, and he said, I run this business while working a full-time job, and I have a family. I spend around 45 minutes per day on rock activities, in quotes. It means, you know, developing new features, analyzing customer survey, planning new price points, like doing really solid stuff, and then another 45 minutes managing part-time employees and generally trying to keep up with his inbox. So he's very, very time constrained. So that's another data point. I think I'll speak to his situation and then I'll speak more generally. I think given his situation, it sounds, given that his time is so constrained, I mean, this is when I started thinking about hiring help. And at first it was VAs and then it was contractors, even though I could write the code and really enjoyed writing the code. With only 45 minutes a day for rock activities, I would definitely, or big rock activities, I would seriously think about trying to find a good developer. And I think that's the thing, right? Is he saying, how can I train my thinking to allow myself to get out of the way? So it sounds like he already knows what the right answer is in his situation. And I think that assuming that, you know, the web app features and having more of them are going to help the business grow, that there is enough competition that it's warranted, because sometimes that's not the case, right? Sometimes the app is good and it just needs marketing, in which case I wouldn't hire a developer. Just let the app sit there. It's a single feature and it has product market fit and you just need to dump marketing into it, then go do that. But if you really do need ongoing web development to continue acquiring new customers and or compete with competitors, I would heavily, heavily lean in this situation towards finding a good contractor. And I'm glad he suggested a $40 per hour contract, because I think, you know, at $15 an hour, it can introduce a lot of headaches, because you can just, you find lower, kind of less experienced people and they can write crappy code. So yes, there is a hurdle, like a mental hurdle to get over. I think I'd repeat to myself over and over, is this hassle worth it if it grows the business and allows me to quit my job? Like, what is your number one goal here? Is it to quit your job? Is it to have enough money to live on from your business? And what's the fastest way to get there? You know, and it's probably in this case, assuming you do need to develop features, it's going to be hiring someone. I would also look, like, everyone else has done this, or I shouldn't say everyone else, but a lot of people have done this. Like, I made this work on a shoestring budget in exactly the almost exactly the scenario you're talking about. So have many other people. Hiring developers when we were developers and it felt weird. And yes, you micromanage it first and you just figure it out. As entrepreneurs, like, we tend to have growth mindsets. We tend to be somewhat flexible, even if we don't think we are with our code. And eventually you will, I think, feel better about it. Now, more generally, when people ask this question, I kind of say, what do you really want to do? What's going to make you happy? Like, what is your goal here? See, my goal early on was to quit consulting and quit my job. And that was more important to me than continuing coding, even though I really, really like to code. And so for me, the quickest way to get there was to go out and buy web apps or to pay contractors to build things, because I was working 8-10 hours a day. I was booked full time, billing 100 to 150 an hour. It didn't make sense for me to take days when I was earning that money and go write something when I could hire someone back then for $20 an hour that was decent. That was my number one goal. And I was willing to sacrifice writing code even though I loved it. Some people are not, and that's okay. You know, I listened to the Art of Product podcast with my co-founder Derek and Ben Orenstein, who a lot of folks know from MicroConf and Thoughtbot. And I'm pretty sure at one point he said, yeah, if I'm going to do a software product, I want to write the code. Like, I don't want to get out of it. And it's like, that's okay. You can totally do this. You know, you look at what Derek did. Derek still wrote a bunch of the code on Drip, or all the code for the first year. He found, in that case, he found essentially a non-technical co-founder in me. For Ben, I would just say, okay, so go into the business, put that constraint on it. You can do whatever you want. And you're just going to have to move a little slower, which is fine. You're probably going to have to contract out to do other things that normally I would tell you to do, like being the chief operations officer and, you know, helping with support and hiring and da, 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 da. If you're really in the code, you need to be shielded from that. So you're going to need to find somebody that can help shield you and build a simpler product, because you can't build and market and do sales and do all those things for a bigger product if you're not going to delegate the code. It's going to be a challenge for you long-term, but there are people that do it. There are Peter, the CEO of Teamwork, he still writes some code. I'm sure he would admit that it's probably not the best use of his time at times, you know, at 100, 150 person company, but he enjoys it so much that he still wants to be part of it. So I think there's leeway here, but best practices, like what I would advise and what I think maximizes your chance of success and will get you there faster, is to stop writing code. But I totally think you can succeed while still writing code if it really, really is what you want to do and you love it. And I'll add one final note. I still write code on the weekends. Like, I wrote some crappy PHP script a few weeks ago just to scrape some websites and hit some APIs because it's fun, you know, for no other purpose than to do it. So even though I don't do it for my job, I do have the freedom now to kind of do it for fun and really enjoy it. I think we have time for one more question today. This one is about digital marketing and whether it works for B2B SaaS. This is from Alistair Scott from riskmemo.com. And he says, what's the best marketing channels for a B2B SaaS business? Is digital marketing, such as Facebook, AdWords, et cetera, a viable technique for a B2B SaaS business, or is it too broad? So I don't know if he's talking about digital marketing or paid advertising, because Facebook and AdWords are really more paid advertising. But my app will be ready to market in a couple months, and I will need to target a specific role in a company, the person responsible for health and safety. I'm getting very promising feedback from people within my network, but test digital marketing campaigns as a smoke test haven't been successful. Your thoughts are much appreciated.
I think this is a really hard question to answer because there's so many variables involved in doing, you know, what appears to be just like paid advertising, which I think that's what he's referring to when he says digital marketing, because there's lots of other forms of digital marketing. You could write ebooks, for example. Like, I've seen companies who write an ebook and then they publish it on Amazon and use that as a marketing channel. Now, that's digital marketing, but at the same time, you could also argue that, you know, it's not necessarily marketing because you've got a book that you're selling, but, you know, you could say that's a product, it's a revenue stream. But at the same time, if you have a longer term goal of converting the people who are buying the book into customers of your SaaS application, and the book tells them how to do it, but your SaaS does it for them, then in theory, like, that's a marketing channel for you. It's digital marketing. So I would differentiate between those two and say that digital marketing can absolutely work, but it really depends on the specific implementation of it. In terms of the, like, doing paid advertising, you know, it's hard for me to say. I feel like there are certain types of industries where you know, like paid ads are simply not going to work. And it's not because they can't work. It's because the ROI does not work. The numbers themselves don't make sense. If you have to spend $50 to get a customer and their lifetime value is only 30, yes, you can, you know, spend money out your ears and acquire those customers, but you're losing money every single time. So you can't sell at a loss and make it up on volume. It's not going to happen.
You make it up in volume.
Yeah, that's, you can't do that. I mean, you can, but you're going to go broke. And like, that's the bottom line. Like, you can try to spend your way out of it. And maybe it's possible that you have to do that in the short term to figure out something that you can tweak and optimize, because your first cuts at it are not going to probably work out very well. You're still learning what to do and what things work, what the software does, and how you target different types of people and different companies. Like, all that stuff's kind of there's a learning curve associated with it. And you're not going to be the best at it when you first go out there and try it. But eventually, over time, your costs are going to go down because you're going to get better at it. And you're going to be able to, you know, outperform your competitors and get in front of the right people. That said, even after you have all that, it still may not work out financially because you're still losing money on it. So it could be that there's other things that you have to do aside from paid advertising. But I think that if you're selling a B2B SaaS product, in most cases, doing online marketing in some format is probably going to drive revenue for you, especially if it's a low touch sales process. If it's high touch, the digital marketing may bring awareness, but you may very well have to do like outbound campaigns and cold calling and direct marketing and things like that. So I would combine it if that's the case, but it sounded to me like this question is really aimed directly at, you know, how do I do digital marketing to make it successful?
Yeah, the answer to will this work is I don't know until you try it, right? I mean, that's what I would do. So I would think that your odds are going to be...
Well, it sounds like he's tried it and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Here's what I would think. Facebook, I can't imagine working for this. I don't know. I don't think you can get someone's title from Facebook, can you, in the ads? I don't know what their segmentation's like these days.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so, but...
Yeah. So here's the two things I would try for this: outbound email and LinkedIn advertising. Yep. LinkedIn advertising, because you can then target based on someone's title, their job title. You could target regions and all that stuff. And then outbound email, because then you just go somewhere, you find a list, outbound email or calling, you know, whatever it is, because then you can find a list of people and, you know, it's cold calling in essence, but at least you know that they are the role that you need if it's that specific. I could see toying around with some AdWords, because you don't necessarily need someone to be the role, but you need them to be searching for something that implies they need your software. The problem with that is it's just going to be too expensive. I don't know any AdWords keywords anymore that are possibly affordable unless your LTV is just through the roof. So those are the two things I would try. Yeah, Facebook, I would say probably not. AdWords, probably too expensive. So thanks for the question. I hope that helps.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for today. If you have a question, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startuptherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startuptherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.